Blog Talk Radio. Hi, good evening, and welcome once again to Madame Perry's Salon, the podcast that loves you. I am your hostess, your groove mistress, and cruise director, Madame Perry, but you can call me Jen, Jennifer, JP, Perry. I'm just happy to be here with you. Thank you to everyone who's been subscribing on different podcast platforms and the people who have been leaving me nice reviews on Stitcher and on Apple iTunes. I really appreciate that. I want to know what you like and what you want to hear more of. And one of the things you tell me often on there, and this is important to me, people have said they like the fact that some guests are people they have heard of. They may be a well-known author or an actor, maybe somebody from Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries or an 80s rocker or an author they like, or sometimes it's people they don't know who also fit in those categories, or maybe an anthrozoologist or a historian or a NASA JPL expert. It doesn't matter. You say that you like them all. You like people you know and learning things and from people that you don't know. And I appreciate the feedback on that because, yeah, it's a good fun mix. And I've been very, very fortunate to have such a variety of people. Also, someone messaged me again and asked, who are the winners of the books from poet Julie E. Blumicki and also from crime thriller author Matt Coyle? Well, I have an airship captain, Captain Anthony LaGrange, also known as Tony Ballard Smoot, and he's going to draw the winners in his costume with the background, the whole thing. Apparently, it's the same one he uses, the background and costume he uses for meetings for Zoom meetings with his corporate job at a bank. So, although I know him from the steampunk world and got to meet him last year. So anyway, he's been busy, but as soon as Tony does the drawing for the winners, I will have those for you. Also later, you might have heard last week and last night, I had a promo for a Kickstarter for a vegan belt called Belt of Orion, invented by a woman in Canada. And I have a short interview with her. I'll be playing that later in the show. Also, another promo from Mossiane Petite Jackson. And she has a book called Thriller Betrayal. It's a three-part series all about her life growing up, as she said, as the first or the oldest daughter of King of Pop, Michael Jackson. So I'll be playing that later on too, before the end of the show. But now this is going to be so much fun. Many of you people already know tonight's guest, and I love people that have such a varied background and experiences. It's very exciting. This man, I don't know where to start, except that he's a former professional baseball player. We're going to ask about that. Current forensic scientist, way cool. An endurance athlete, author, and screenwriter. So we're going to be talking about his books, but we're also going to find out, we're going to see what we can find out about the very fascinating and obviously very intelligent and talented Greg Hickey. Welcome to Madame Perry Salon, Greg. Get comfortable.
Thank you very much, Jennifer. That was quite an introduction. Thank you.
Endurance athlete. You know, I got to ask you, pistol squats. What's your high number?
Yes. Oh, I don't know. I've never tried to go for a record pistol squat.
Okay. Sorry, I did CrossFit for about a year, and we had to do those on a truck tire.
Yeah, I have done them. They're tough for me because I'm not that flexible, so getting down that low is a little tough. But I do them occasionally, but I've never tried to go for a consecutive record.
Okay. Yeah. And that's an easy thing too, to wherever you are, whether you're in a chair or whatever, pretty much anywhere you are, you can do that. So yeah, that was one of my favorites. Former international professional baseball player, where have you played? What team?
In Sweden and South Africa. So when I was in college, I did a study abroad program, a semester in Cape Town, South Africa. And I played baseball in college, and while I was in South Africa, I was at the gym at the University of Cape Town. I would go early in the morning before classes, and I would, you know, either lift weights or do some baseball drills in the gym. And one day I was there, and another student, I guess, saw me come in and come into the weight room and put my glove in the ball in one of the cubbies in the weight room. And he came up to me, you know, during my workout and said, introduced himself and said he played on a local baseball team and asked me if I would be interested in playing with them. So I played with this team, the Crusaders, in a suburb of Cape Town for the time I was there, which was about 4 months. So got me through about 2 months of their season. And I went back home to the States, you know, finished my degree. When I was about to graduate, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do next. And it was very fortunate that my college baseball coach had played and coached overseas and continued to do so even, you know, when I was in college. He would play and coach during the summers in Sweden and around Europe. So he had contact with a team in Sweden that was looking for a player and coach for the summer. So he asked me if I'd be interested, and I jumped at the opportunity. So probably a couple weeks after I graduated from college, I was on a plane to Sweden and then landed in Stockholm and took a train up north to a small town called Sundsvall. So I spent the summer there playing and coaching for a local baseball team. So I played and coached with the adult team and then coached the under-16 team. After I finished there, I decided I would like to go back to South Africa and play a full season with the Crusaders, the team I had played a short season with earlier. So I went home to Chicago for about a month and then flew to South Africa and spent about 6 months in South Africa playing a full season there.
That's fantastic. What I like about that is that you said when you had the first offer that, you know, you jumped at the chance, because so many times people will say, well, I don't know. Well, what about this? And will I miss out on something else? But some of these kind of opportunities, they don't just come along for everyone. And they generally don't come along a second time if you turn it down the first time. So did you just have an adventurous spirit, or since you did the study abroad, you obviously already like travel, cultures, and places.
Right, yeah. And I was very lucky to grow up with a family that traveled a lot. So I really enjoyed traveling and enjoyed seeing other places and other cultures. When I did my study abroad program, I really wanted to go somewhere that was different than the United States. And so, you know, my options for an English-speaking curriculum are really limited to somewhere in the UK or South Africa. So South Africa seemed like a really fascinating place to visit, given their recent history and the diversity of culture. That was definitely true. I really, really enjoyed my time in South Africa, and I really loved the city of Cape Town. So I really, you know, didn't think twice about going to Sweden after, you know, when my coach gave me that opportunity, an opportunity that I was very lucky to have, something kind of I really never expected to get into when I started playing baseball as a young kid. But, you know, really lucky that came up for me, and it was another great experience.
That is fantastic. And, yes, it's an irreplaceable experience, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And, yeah, my husband traveled for years with his job around the country, where he'd be the places be several times in Africa, Vietnam, England, Germany, Australia, all sorts of places. And, you know, he said, I never dreamed growing up that I'd get to see these places that I'd seen in movies or in books, you know, and then he's loved it. And he's kept a lot of friends. Do you still communicate with a lot of people in the Crusaders?
Occasionally, yeah. More from South Africa than from Sweden, I would say. I think just because I went to South Africa twice, and the second time I was there, I stayed with a host family, so I got to be pretty close to them. My wife and I got the chance to go back to Africa and to visit Cape Town a couple of years ago now. We got to see my host family again, sort of reconnect with them, which was really nice.
Oh, that's nice. That's great. Your wife got to go and meet people that you knew.
Yeah. It was exciting for me to take her back and show her around the city and introduce her to my friends and, you know, people I spent a lot of time with there.
I would imagine, too, that feeds a lot into your work. But you started writing, as I understand, from your website, you started your first novel after seventh grade, the summer after seventh grade.
Yes.
I guess I could say I
started it, and it didn't get very far. So when I was in seventh grade, I was assigned at some point to write a short story for class, or multiple short stories, but there was one that I especially liked, and I think, you know, my teacher enjoyed it, and I don't know if I brought it to the class or she brought it to the class, but I think some of my classmates gave me some good feedback about it. And it was a story about a cruise ship that was shipwrecked on a deserted island. It was kind of like a Lord of the Flies situation where the surviving passengers and the cruise ship had to figure out how to survive there and, you know, get into disagreements and whatnot. But I enjoyed the experience of writing the story, so I decided that the summer after seventh grade, I was going to spend that summer turning the story into a full novel. So I had great intentions, but I quickly realized that I much preferred being outside with my friends rather than, you know, sitting alone in my family's basement working on a novel.
Well, maybe you'll revisit it one day, because I can see where a book or especially a film of this story, if it's a shipwrecked cruise liner, you won't have to explain, as we always wondered with Gilligan's Island, if it was a 3-hour cruise, how did they have so many clothes? But you got a cruise liner there. People got dinnerware. They got daytime clothes. They got sweat. Yeah, that would be.
Yeah, that would make more sense. Yeah,
a lot more believable. So when did you get started? When did you really begin to write seriously?
I would say really a little bit in college, but mostly the summer after I graduated from college. So I was in Sweden playing and coaching for this local team, and my responsibilities for that team were really limited to coaching and participating in the adult practice, which is probably 2 nights a week, playing and coaching the adult games. So we usually have 2 games on a Saturday or a Sunday. And then I would maybe coach one of the younger team's practices a week, and then occasionally have a game with them on the weekend or a tournament with them on the weekend. So I really had a lot of time during the days in the week where I was pretty much left to my own devices. And I used a lot of that time to start writing my first novel. And the same was true when I was in South Africa. I had a part-time job for a while, or really a temporary job for a little bit. So I was working 8-hour days, but then that assignment ended. So I had some time for myself to continue writing the novel. And by the time I came home to Chicago, after about 10 months, I had the first draft of what would become my first novel.
All right. And that was Our Dried Voices?
Correct.
All right. Then tell us about, for people who aren't familiar with your work, would you tell us about Our Dried Voices?
Absolutely.
Because this was a finalist, I understand, for the Forward Review's Indie Science Fiction Book of the Year that year, in 2014?
Yes, it was. Right. So I'm very excited and pleased with that recognition, especially for my first novel, so it was definitely very gratifying. But Our Dried Voices is a dystopian fiction novel. It's about a future human colony on a distant planet, and the story is set in the future when humans have basically cured all diseases and have solved the problem of feeding large populations and been able to figure out how to control the climate and technologies like that. So the humans in this colony on a distant planet have basically set up everything so that the colony takes care of the humans and they don't have to worry about sustaining their own lives. So there are machines that make food and feed the colonists. There are machines that clean all the buildings in the colony. And the colonists are basically these blissfully ignorant people who kind of spend their day playing out in these meadows and then, you know, go to the meal halls when it's time to eat, go to the sleeping halls when it gets dark and it's time to go to bed. And they don't really have to think about all the mechanisms behind their existence. So everything goes along very smoothly for the colonists until the machines in the colony start breaking down. And then the colonists, and especially one colonist in particular who's the protagonist of the story, has to figure out how to solve the problem, to figure out what's going on with the colony and try to rescue everybody who's living there.
Oh, my. Okay. I was going to say, it almost sounds like the Jetsons, but gone sideways.
Because, yeah.
because they didn't have jobs there. So, well, okay. All right. And so to get to be a finalist for the Forward Reviews in the Sci-Fi Book of the Year then, your first novel out. Yeah, like I said, they had to, I'm sure it was quite gratifying and exciting, not only for you, but for your friends and your family reading this too.
Yeah, that was, you know, my friends and family have been great, you know, really supportive, especially my parents and my wife, you know. It's a lonely profession at times being a novelist because you're stuck in front of a computer a lot. And so my wife and my schedule works out nicely in that by the end of the week, my wife, who gets up very early to go to work every day, is usually pretty tired on Friday night. But she goes to bed early, and I'm able to stay up late and kind of gather everything I've read during the week, during my breaks at work, and occasionally I get time on weeknights. And I'm able to take all that work on a Friday night and kind of start compiling it and putting it into whatever draft I'm working on.
So does your wife read? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Does your wife ever read your work, and do you ever ask her to critique it or see how things flow?
Yes, all the time. She is, I think for all of my novels, she's been the last person I've asked to read a book before it gets published, because she's a very careful reader, and she's able to pick out any lingering typos or other errors that I've missed, or even that editors have missed along the way. So she's the last person I want to see before it's ready for publication, just to make sure that everything is as good as it can be.
Right, that's nice. Before you wrote Our Dried Voices, and I believe it was when you were still in college, was when you wrote your first screenplay, Vita.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
All right. I was going to say, first novel, Vita, went on to, and this was your first screenplay, you're still in college, and Vita also won an honorable mention at the 2010 Los Angeles Movie Awards Script Competition and was a finalist in the 2011 Sacramento International Film Festival. And those are not slack awards. Those are pretty prestigious.
Well, thank you.
Congratulations.
Yeah, so thank you very much. And so, again, it's definitely, you know, exciting and an honor to get that recognition. The tough thing about a screenplay is that it takes a lot of people to get off the ground and turn into a movie. So even though I had, you know, some recognition with that script, nothing's really come of it. It was optioned at one point, which means that the producer has the rights to make it into a film for whatever term period you set. And so I think it was a one-year option. And then if nothing happens in that 1 year, then open game again. But nothing happened with it in that year. Really, nothing's happened with it since. So far, that's my first and only screenplay. I've enjoyed writing novels up to this point, and all the ideas I've had lately seem to lend themselves more to prose rather than a screenplay. So that's the direction I've gone since then.
Now, The Friar's Lantern, that's your most recent book?
Yes.
Okay. And so I've listened to some interviews you've done about that. So I'm going to ask you here, first of all, how did you come up with the idea? What is the story about, and how did that idea come to you?
Sure. So The Friar's Lantern is told as an interactive novel. Readers who are familiar with the Choose Your Own Adventure series that was popular in the 80s and 90s will recognize this style. But basically, the reader is the protagonist in the story. So the story is told in the second person, which means that the text is written as you do this, you do that. And at various points in the story, the text will say, okay, if you want to do X, turn to page 5. If you want to do Y, turn to page 10, or something like that. So the reader actually gets to choose how the story continues. I thought this was a cool idea, and I enjoyed reading the Choose Your Own Adventure series when I was growing up, and related books that were doing interactive style. So I was in college, and I remember I had the idea to try to update this style for a more adult audience. I later realized that I was not the first person to come up with this idea. There are several other writers who have written interactive novels for adults. But that was a cool idea, and I wanted to – it took me a while to find the story idea that would fit with the style. And I hit on the idea a couple of years later of making a choose-your-own-path novel, tell a story, and start to explore the idea of choice. So in philosophical terms, it's about free will versus determinism, where free will is the idea that we consciously deliberate among various options and then actively select which option we want to pursue. So if I'm presented with the choice between chocolate and vanilla ice cream, I deliberate, I think about my taste preferences, and I decide, okay, I like chocolate better. I want to choose chocolate. It's possible that I could have chosen vanilla if I felt like it on that day or something, but I actively decided to choose chocolate. The opposite view is determinism, which says that actually we don't really choose at all. Our actions are dictated by causal forces, whether that's in our upbringing, our genetics, the circumstances, our environment at the time, and so forth. So when I'm presented with chocolate and vanilla ice cream, it's not some part of my brain that's consciously deliberating and selecting what ice cream flavor I want, but it's my genetics. You know, my taste buds are more attuned to a bitter flavor like chocolate rather than a sweeter flavor like vanilla, and so I choose chocolate because that's the way my body works.
Yeah, I've heard you say. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I've also heard you say that, you know, younger audiences are more accustomed to choose your own adventure, you know, choose your own outcome novel. I've only been introduced to one, and that was at a book expo America years ago when Neil Patrick Harris wrote his autobiography that way. So how it could be an autobiography where you choose the adventure. You know, I didn't get that far into it, but I didn't realize, you know, as you said, that's what younger audiences are more accustomed to. So how difficult is that to create the story in that way? So it's not just a straight linear path, or is it? But just different lines.
No, it definitely presents some unique challenges. So one of the differences between The Friar's Lantern and the old Choose Your Own Adventure series is that most readers of The Friar's Lantern will get through to the end of the story. So there aren't points in the story where you're going to die or the story will just end because you run into some, you know, contrived dead end. You're going to get through to the end of the story and you're going to make, you know, the big decisions at the end of the story. But as far as structuring the novel, there are still, you know, branching paths throughout the story that, you know, diverge and then intersect again. And so that was a unique challenge. And there were two things that really helped me kind of keep the story straight, both in terms of planning it and then executing the writing. So the first thing I did was try to draw out a map of how the story would go. So I, you know, had a blank sheet of paper, started at the top of page with one line, you know, the initial setup of the story that broke into two lines. Okay, you follow this path, or you follow path A or path B, and then each of those two lines broke into two more lines, and so forth, all the way down the page. And it looked really neat at the top of the page, but by the time I got to the bottom, the lines were crisscrossing and swirling all over the place and intersecting and diverging again. So it didn't look very neat. It certainly wasn't a work of art, but at least it helped me visualize how I wanted the story to go. And it was kind of a visual outline for what I wanted to include in the story and where I wanted to include it. So that was the first thing that really helped me. I've shown them that story map to some people, and I don't know if they appreciate it or not. I mean, it looks like a mess, but for me at least, I could kind of decipher it, and I could figure out, okay, here's, you know, where I need to put this part of the story and where it comes in sequence and what path it branches off of and where it either ends or merges back into the main storyline. The second thing I did was I knew it was going to be a problem dealing with page numbers. So So if I were to say in my first draft, turn to page 5, and then I were to, you know, add 3 pages in front of page 5, then suddenly it'd be page 8, and I would, you know, in the next draft to delete a page, and then it'd be page 7. I didn't want to have to be constantly changing the page numbers every time I made a major edge to the story. So I would label each story section with a 3-letter code, like AAA, BBB, and so forth. And then when I would make a choice, instead of saying, you know, turn to page 5, I would say turn to page AAA. And then it would be easy for me to find each section within the document just by doing a search function in Microsoft Word. And I wouldn't have to worry about changing all the page numbers every time I made a revision. And then when the book went to publication, it was pretty easy just to go back in and say, okay, page AAA refers to page 5, so let's input 5 in there. Page BBB refers to page 10, so let's put 10 in there, and so forth.
All right. I think you would have to be a scientist to put that together like that. I can't imagine doing it. I just see from my computer science classes, the sets of algorithms, you know, if this, then this, you know, then it goes here and there, and putting that together. What is the significance of the title, The Friar's Lantern?
So the term Friar's Lantern is a synonym of the term Will-o'-the-Wisp or Ignis Fatuus, which is the Latin word for foolish fire. And all these terms refer to the ghostly light that is sometimes seen at night over marshy ground. And this light results from the oxidation of gases produced by the decomposition of organic material. So it's a sort of flickering ghostly light, you know, that can appear in sort of unsafe ground. And in folklore, people would warn against the Friar's Lantern and the Will-o'-the-Wisp because if travelers were to follow this ghostly light, they could stumble onto unsafe ground or unstable ground. So in the novel, The Friar's Lantern, the title refers to this ghostly light, but it also serves as a warning for readers that, you know, readers are on this path through the story and they get to choose where they go in the story. So it's sort of a warning to the readers to, you know, try to stay on the safe path or the true path and not be deceived by these false ideas that pop up throughout the book.
Interesting. There's something on this page, though. It says, on the page of your website where it says, The Friar's Lantern, you may win $1 million, you will judge a man of murder.
Yes, so those...
Now, that's a pretty bold 2 sentences, right?
Yes, so those sentences refer to the 2 main plot lines in the story. So at the outset of the story, you, the protagonist, go to a laboratory where you decide to participate in a research experiment. And the experiment is about predicting human behavior. So this scientist puts you into an MRI machine that scans your brain, and you're presented with this choice. Basically, you're going to have 2 boxes, and you'll get to choose either one box or both boxes. And there's some terms of the choice that kind of play in. But basically, the MRI is trying to predict what you're going to choose. And depending on what you choose and what the MRI predicts, you could end up with $1 million or more in winnings. So it could be very lucrative, or you could end up with nothing. So the second story path is you are called to jury duty, and you are assigned to be a juror on this murder case. And the case is about a university professor who is accused of killing a man that he believes murdered his wife. So you sit on this trial, and you go through all the evidence, and at the end of the story, you have to decide, is this man innocent or guilty of murder?
Well... And what kind of reactions have you got from your readers about it? I mean, I could read reviews, but what do your readers tell you without giving anything away?
Sure. So my goal has really always been to try to write entertaining stories for smart readers. And I think with The Friar's Lantern, that's really the reaction I've got. So a lot of readers will say, you know, it's entertaining, but it makes you think. You know, it's fun, but it's challenging. Thought-provoking, but it's an enjoyable and relatively fast-paced read. So that's definitely good to hear. It makes me feel like I'm on the right track, and I kind of, for the most part, hit the mark with the novel.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, I know you haven't done it lately, but I see a lot of pictures where you seem to get out a lot and read and do in-person book readings and signings and so forth. How do you like that? And what do you do now that you're not getting out as much, or we can't get out to do that yet?
I do always enjoy doing those. I've done them for the launches for both my books, For Our Dry Voices and The Fire's Lantern. Like you mentioned, I haven't done one for a while, both because I haven't released the book for a while and also because, we're all under stay-at-home orders and a lot of bookstores aren't open. In the past, I have done an online virtual reading and signing and Q&A. I think would like to do that again. I've got a novel coming out in October, so the plan right now is to do a few of those, which is nice because I have, readers that don't live in Chicago where I live and can't come to a in-person book signing. So hopefully that's an opportunity for them to be able to connect with me and ask a little bit more about the book and find out about a little more about me and the way I write and the stories I'm trying to tell.
But pardon me if I've missed this, but have you done much online reading to where people can interact with you or leave comments like on Facebook or Zoom or something?
I've only done one before. I've put out a short prequel to The Friar's Lantern a couple years ago, early last year. And I set up a video on my website. So it was hosted on my website, but I did it through YouTube. So it's basically just, I would write a little bit from the book. I took questions from the audience. I had a chat box on the website where they could type in questions. I would answer them on the video. Had the opportunity for them to purchase books and have me sign them live on video. So it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that opportunity to be able to connect with my readers, especially readers who don't live in the same city or state as I do.
Yeah, that's that's an interesting thing to we're having to change so many things now. And since I'm an entertainment publicist, I've had people come to me and I was saying, okay, now what do we do? Now you can't, because I've always been one of my fortes is what I call the unconventional book tour. So if my clients are authors, I'll put them in places like I put them in wellness centers, wine bars, art galleries, coffee shops, just all kinds of unusual places where, people, you don't have to be in a bookstore to be needing a book. And there's a guy, Charlie Wilson, if you've ever heard of, could be a little before your time, but a funk band called the Gap Band. And Charlie's the drummer. Okay, well, Charlie Wilson, the drummer for the band, singer, songwriter, he still tours on his own. And believe me, a lot of people have heard of him because I'd love to see him, but I can't afford the $150 ticket. But he wrote a book about a memoir, and he had a book signing at, would you believe, the DMV. And I thought, oh, man, I would love to do that. I'd love to put a client there or at a place where you get your tires, get a new set of tires, because there are people just bored. And people, gosh knows, people at the DMV, if you're there for a while, you want something to read, something different.
Sure.
So what is the, have you ever done sort of an unusual, unconventional situation like that where you've gone to read or sign your book in something outside a bookstore?
No, I've only ever done bookstores, but this is a great new idea. So when you do this, do you pick a place that kind of ties in with the author's book? So if your author's writing about food or wine, will you choose a wine bar or a restaurant versus if your author's writing about health and wellness,
do.
Wellness center?
Yeah, actually, yes, I have because the wellness center, that was a woman who hired me who put her book out, and all of a sudden it's Thanksgiving, and she goes, hey, my book's already out. What can you do? And I'm going, okay, we're going into Christmas. Everybody's already been booked since June for this. So, I had to pull something out. I had to pull a rabbit out of the hat. So for that, I thought, well, let's see, Christmas. I put her in a wine bar locally because that way my press release can say, take a load off, have a seat, have another glass of, have another margarita or a glass of wine. And I had the client prepared to go ahead and gift wrap her books, you know, have the paper cut to the right size. And her sisters were there, so they would autograph and gift wrap books. That way you can mark some names off your list, relax a little bit. And that's how I promoted that. With another client, though, her book was a dystopian novel set in the future. And because people had to make do with what they already had and repurpose furniture, there were no more factories and no new things coming out. But people had to use what they had or trade it or sell it and reuse. I found a, not exactly an antique store, but they would resell, like, you know, things, mid-century modern decor or photographs or paintings or furniture, clothes, jewelry, everything. And so I told them, I told the guys, I said, you know, we're not a bookstore, right? And I said, yes, but in the book, they have to use what they have. And everything you have is, you know, resale, kind of upscale flea market stuff or regular flea market. So that's where the tie-in is. And they And so it was the two owners, one of them says, well, I can't believe you sold us on this because you talked to my husband and he doesn't even read, but I do. So, yeah, so we went ahead and did it. It was a lot of fun, you know, and they brought in new people and we made it work. So, yeah, things like that. So that's where I was wondering, you know, now that you've thinking about that or now that we've talked about it, where would you like to have something that would be different? I mean, for gosh sakes, a gym, because you're an endurance athlete. Those guys got to read sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Gym would be good. I'm trying to think for my next novel, and I don't, maybe this would not be a good idea, but my next novel is about a mass shooting incident at a beach in Chicago. So I don't know if we'd want to do a beach or if the subject matter would be too grim for a day at the beach. We could, you know, set up a little tent on the beach, something like that. So I don't know. Now I'll have to really think about that.
Yeah, do. If you need some help, give me a call. That would be a good place to do it. Or this client also, her sister was a musician, so she sat in with this jazz band at a club, and they let the girl sell her or the woman sell her book there too. So I know there's a lot of jazz places in Chicago because I've got a good friend, Paul Marinaro, that performs at a lot of them there. So, we could put you anywhere, Greg, for Pete's sake. Everybody would love you. Tell me about some of your other books that were, have you ever had a book or story you've written that ended up being kind of a surprise to you? Like you start off with an idea, maybe a concept, a plot, and it goes to a surprising place.
Usually not. Writers kind of describe themselves as planners and pantsers, the latter being people who write from the seat of their pants, fly by the seat of their pants. And I'm more of a planner. So Outright Voices and the Fires and I Turn were both very much planned out in advance and in pretty painstaking detail. The novel I'm working on right now, which is going to come out in the fall, it's called Parabellum, was a little bit more of that, you know, fly by the seat of my pants approach. So I kind of had an idea of, how I wanted the story to start and had an idea of how I wanted to end. But the way I ended up writing it was I would focus on one character and I would just write scenes for that character as they came to me. And there are four main characters in the story. So we'd do one character, write several scenes over the course of a few weeks, then move on to the next character and write a bunch of scenes. So really when I wrote the rough draft, I didn't have a cohesive draft so much as, you know, 40 odd scenes. But I didn't have to go back and store it and put it in a chronological order, more or less chronological order. So the whole process of actually getting from first draft to second draft was actually figuring out, okay, here's how the story's actually going to progress, and here are some gaps in the story where I need to write additional scenes, or here's a scene that doesn't really fit that I need to delete altogether. So that was a little bit more of a, I'm not quite sure where the middle of this story is going to go and how I'm going to get from beginning to end. It's more figuring it out as it went along and sort of, you know, having these characters in mind and trying to write in a way that was true to the characters and felt like it was something that the characters would do and choices the characters would make, and letting their personality sort of dictate how the story went.
Well, we're looking forward to Parabellum. And you say it's going to be published in October?
Yes.
All right. I hope you'll come back and talk to us about it. All of your books have great covers. But looking at the cover, since you do give us a sneak peek at it, or a preview, the cover for Parabellum, gorgeous, but...
Yes, I'm really excited about it. I think the designer did a great job, so I'm very pleased with how that turned out.
Yeah, it's got a bit of almost a 3D effect where you look like you're peeking into the story just from the cover, and
yeah,
I like
absolutely.
That. You've got the colors for the beach, but then the peek into the city, so... Yeah, okay, well, definitely, and I hope you will come back for that.
Oh, I'd love to.
Okay, good, please, go ahead. We got it here. I've got it on tape. you also have a book called Theory of Anything, and so, I've got a few more minutes with you. Will you tell me what that's about?
Absolutely. So I touched on this briefly earlier. It is a short prequel to The Friar's Lantern. So when I was talking about The Friar's Lantern, I mentioned this university professor who was accused of killing a man that he believes murdered his wife. Well, Theory of Anything kind of goes into the circumstances of how the professor was arrested and what led to his alleged... And it's a story about his relationship with his wife and what happened after her death and him grieving and also making this breakthrough mathematical discovery at the same time. And so I published it as a prequel to The Friar's Lantern, and it's intended to be an introduction for readers who are new to my writing. So it's available for free on my website. Readers go to my website and search for The Theory of Anything. It should be easy to find. They can download it for free and get an introduction to my writing style and decide if they think it works for them, if they want to continue on to The Friar's Lantern.
All right. And the website is greghickeywrites.com. And, of course, I'll
correct.
Be sharing that on all of my social media, not only for Madame Perry Salon, but also for Jennifer Perry on all of them, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. You've seen it on some of those already, but as you know, I always keep sharing it because people always ask me. And also a lot of people listen to the podcast. They tell me when they're driving or when they're running or something, so they can't always write it down, but they know where to find it. Greg, I just wish you so much success. It's such a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm so grateful that you were so generous with your time tonight.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed this conversation, so I appreciate you having me on the show.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure. All right, folks, and after I've also got the interview coming up with Rania, who created the Belt of Orion, and also Mosiane Petite Jackson. And for right now, again, look for Greg Hickey, author, screenwriter. This man is fascinating, and I can promise you from what I've read and from the interviews, and I'm just about to start on Friar's Lantern this weekend, but the parts that I've read so far, this is not your ordinary book. This is not one where you're going to know where it goes or say that I've read this plot before. This is something fresh, very exciting, and very entrancing. He's an extraordinary word crafter. And thank you again, Greg Hickey. And remember, you've always got a home here at Madame Perry Salon.
Thank you very much, Jennifer. I appreciate it.
All right, you're quite a pleasure. And now I've got a word from our friend Charles Barkley, and I'll be back with Rania.
So, Chuck, talk to us about Fizdale being the Knicks' new coach. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I tell you right now, Ernie, it don't matter who gonna coach this team. They don't got no talent on
we
it, and
man.
I don't really feel like talk.
That's kind of harsh.
I don't feel like talk about the Knicks right
you
now.
Talk about lunch?
No.
What would you like to talk about, Chuck?
See, Ernie, I've been listening to a podcast called Madame Perry Salon, and I think Jennifer Perry, she's a great host. I mean, she got all these bestseller authors, Rostov, all the comedians.
What about people that don't have rings?
Here we go.
I got
real
fun.
But I think she's great, and I think people would love her show. She got a great laugh. She make the laugh come out of nowhere like an eagle come in there and just steal the whole show. It's a beautiful thing. It's not terrible.
You know, my book, Thriller, The Dark Side of the Netherlands, I'm really talking for the first time about my kidnapping. I mean, many people think it's funny that I'm saying Michael Jackson is my father, but they are not realizing how much I've been traumatized because of that, how much I suffered because of that. You know, people have been murdered on the night I was kidnapped. I mean, the media laugh about it, but you know, I still remember as an 8-year-old child that people are being killed in front of me in many ways, but I also remember walking in the blood. So that my book called Thriller Betrayal and Thriller The Dark Side is in the Netherlands, not because I like the name Thriller, because a real thriller have been happening to me, and I'm happy I survived it still.
So if you've been listening last week and you've been checking my social media, you see that I've been talking about a Kickstarter for a new product, very exciting, called the Belt Orion. It's a virtually indestructible belt. And tonight, I have the inventor, the creator of the Belt of Orion, here with us to talk about it. Renya, welcome to Madame Perry Salon.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
So, Renya, tell us, what is Truth Belts?
Truth Belts is the name of my company, which I started back in 2001 here in Toronto, Canada. And I have been making and designing vegan fashion accessories ever since. And the product is primarily belts, and everything is 100% animal friendly and made in Canada.
What is Belt of Orion?
Well, the Belt of Orion is my latest creation, which I'm really excited about. It's a new virtually indestructible belt that is so strong. So anybody out there who typically destroys their belts would love it because it doesn't crack at the holes. It lasts a long time. It's nickel-free for anybody who has allergies to nickel. And it doesn't have the gruesome energy of animals that have been abused, because I think we're seeing more and more information today coming through that's, you know, showing us that maybe animals aren't treated as we think they are as they go through the animal agriculture system. So in a nutshell, it's a really strong vegan belt for men that goes great with jeans.
What is it made of that makes it so strong?
Well, I discovered a secret from the Mennonites, who were using this man-made material for their horses, reins, and harnesses because it's stronger than leather and it wouldn't crack over time up here with the Canadian winters and all the seasons. You know, just it was just so long-lasting, so durable. And once I discovered this, I thought, well, why don't I use this for a belt? So that's the secret, and it's a material that is seatbelt webbing on the inside, so you know your seatbelt in your car. Okay, that's the inside. Mm-hmm. And then it's coated with a special vinyl that is, it complies with North American standards for making vinyl. It's made in the United States. And they also use the same material in, you know, the military, health, and sporting industries. So it's very, very durable.
Why did you call it Belt of Orion?
Well, you know, Belt of Orion is something that we all notice when we look up to the night sky. If you're into astronomy or you love gazing up, it's a star constellation, which is called the Belt of Orion. It's probably one of the most popular star constellations, probably after the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper. If you join the stars together for the Orion star constellation, it creates a stick figure of a person. And it kind of looks like he's holding like a bow or something. So historically, this stick figure in the sky has been seen as like a warrior or a hunter. But I decided to create my own story. And I, with my imagination, I just used, I had a little bit of fun. And I made this into an archer. So somebody holding a bow and arrow. And the story that I'm going with is that she shoots this magical arrow to planet Earth to help us out and help us wake us up to the fact that we're all interconnected and that what happens in one part of the planet affects us all. So that's the story that I created. So I just kind of wanted to change it into being something a little bit more, you know, like negative and about, you know, war and killing into something more positive. So that's why I called it Orion, and I've embossed the word Orion on the back of the belt, which makes that really cool.
Is it only for the vegan and vegetarian market?
Absolutely not. If you are a guy who typically destroys your belts, you would love this belt because it's not going to fall apart, you know, after like, you know, a year or two, like a lot of other belts out there. It's really for anybody who just wants a long-lasting belt and who wears pants.
You had a Vedic astrology reading recently and discovered that your chart is in Orion. Tell me about that.
Yes, that was the really auspicious thing about this whole creation of this belt. So during the coronavirus lockdown, on May 6th, I had my astrology chart done, Vedic astrology, which is different from Western astrology. And I'd never had that experience before. So, you know, I thought I would just try something new. So it was very accurate. And one of the questions that I asked during the interview was I just asked about this belt because I was feeling kind of unsure about what was happening in the world, and I wanted to find out if there would be a better time for me to launch this on Kickstarter. So while I was asking my question and describing my belt of Orion to the reader or to the astrologer, he stopped me mid-sentence and he said, "By the way, you know that your chart is actually in Orion?" And I was like, "What?" And he said, "Yes, you know, Gemini is your sign, but in fact, that part of Gemini where your sun is in fact the star Betelgeuse, which is the shoulder star of Orion. So he said that my sun conjuncts the star Betelgeuse. So no kidding, Orion is prominent in your chart." And I was like, "Wow, that is very interesting. What does that even mean?" And then he went on to tell me that my Venus, so Venus is, you know, another big planet that affects us. I guess the two main stars in your chart in Vedic astrology that influences you is your sun star and your Venus. So my Venus is a star called Lambda Orion, which is the actual head of Orion. So, you know, the shoulder and the head of Orion are in my personal chart.
Oh, my. How did you feel when you heard that?
I didn't know what to think. I just thought, I think this was meant to be, because I just felt, you know, really passionate about this belt, and I love looking at the stars. I don't even know what to make of it, but I can tell you that since this has happened, I have had four really unusual coincidences around Orion that have come up. The first one was when I hired you. You know, I had just wanted to do a little bit of advertising for this Kickstarter campaign and about my cool belt. So you coincidentally had my commercial play with that man who is an astronomer. What was his name? His name was I forgot his
Thomas
name right
Watson.
Now. Thomas Watson. Yes, thank you. Who happens to be an author and an astronomer. So that was the first coincidence. So I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. The next thing that happened was I had hired somebody to help me with writing an article. So she did that for me because I'm not the greatest writer in the world. So, you know, I get help here and there. And she submitted the article to me, and she told me that her real job, her full-time job, is working for NASA as a laboratory mechanic, and that she had just finished a long test a few months ago on Orion on the next spaceship for the Artemis program. So that was the second thing that happened.
Oh, this is so
I know.
Wild. Okay.
I know. There's two more coincidences. The next thing that happened was I was here in Toronto, and I was at Dora. We have this health food store. They have organic groceries. And so there's a store right across the way. It's called Gifts from the Earth. And they sell high-quality mineral specimens, fossils, stones, telescopes. So in the window, they had this framed, beautiful photo of the Orion star constellation, and they had focused on the three stars, which are Orion's belt. So that was the next thing. I just feel like I'm seeing it everywhere. The last thing that happened was my dear friend who moved to Germany a few months ago, she sent me a photo, and she had purchased a bottle of water from the store, and the brand of the water, Orion.
Oh.
Rinya, so often people wonder, am I going about this the right way? Do I have all my bases covered? Am I true to my purpose? You've invented a product that is durable, something everyone needs,
and
yeah.
create it so that animals don't have to be needlessly suffering because someone needs a belt. And it seems that everywhere you turn, you've been getting positive reinforcement. And that is why I love this story so much.
You know, I really do feel... Yeah, you know what? I really do feel like I somehow have the wind in my back with all these, the forced coincidences that have come up. I just feel like the universe is just telling me something like, you know what, girl? You are on the right path. This is a wonderful product and go for it.
Fantastic. This is an extraordinary product. And as people know, I have been and will continue to share the links to the Kickstarter for Belt of Orion on all of my social media. And go check it out. Read more about it. Make a pledge. Get a belt. Who knows how to change your life.
So,
Rania, how is this belt changing the world?
Well, you know what? I think that, you know, people are really starting to be more conscious about the way they eat. You know, the vegan and vegetarian movement has really grown in the past 10 years. So, you know, not, even if somebody is not willing to switch their diet to vegan or vegetarian, I think people are eating maybe less meat or they're being more conscious of, you know, where they purchase their meat. So there are things that are really shifting. People are just becoming more conscious and they want to know where the food that they are buying, like where was it grown, how was it grown, and they're not willing to, you know, put up with, like, you know, things that are not cool, like all the, you know, antibiotics that are pumped into, you know, not only meat, but like, you know, our fruits and vegetables, and we're becoming conscious of that, and I think the citizens of the world are really starting to wake up and realize that they have a voice and that we can make change by, you know, by taking action. So that's sort of the symbol of the Belt of Orion and with my story too, because, you know, just growing up, I always heard that the Belt of Orion was this warrior in the sky, and that's just what I was told. But then I was like, hey, you know what? That doesn't feel right to me. I'm going to make my own story, and I'm going to, like, put a new spin on it. So we can all do that in 2020. Like, if we feel like we learned something growing up that doesn't fit us, it doesn't seem right, we can do something about it. So that's the message.
Anyone who is interested in checking out the Belt of Orion vegan belt can go to Kickstarter and do a search for Belt of Orion or Truth Belts. And you can also find information on my social media for Madame Perry Salon as well as Jennifer Perry. Again, thank you so much, Rania, and we wish you all the success with Belt of Orion.
So, thank you. Thank you.
Well, when you were the nappy kid, swinging everything you did, you jump and jive and bop and sing, saying everybody's got to swing. But mom and pop were right on time, they helped up all your nursery rhymes. But when you started off your dream of a jive that jitterbug sing, Mother Goose.
Cut a rug.